From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
On Saturday, August 17th, join thousands of people coming from around the country and around the world to Washington, D.C. to demand reparations for African people.
Saturday is the 115th anniversary of the birth of Marcus Garvey. We'll speak with Roger Wareham, an attorney who has brought a lawsuit demanding reparations for African Americans. Supporters of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe evict white farmers as the country hurtles toward land redistribution in the midst of a sub-Saharan drought threatening thousands of lives. We'll have a debate between two Zimbabwean members of parliament and another debate on the secretive media institute disseminating articles about Arabs to the Western media. It's called Memory. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Bacardi Rum Company has been engaged for more than 40 years in clandestine attempts to overthrow the Cuban government by both violent and other means. This according to a new book, Bacardi, The Hidden War, by Colombian journalist Hernando Calvo Ospina. The book accuses the world's largest rum company of spending millions of dollars to bankroll the CIA, U.S. politicians, and extreme right-wing groups in an effort to remove Fidel Castro and reestablish its profitable empire on the island. Cuba nationalized Bacardi's properties in 1959. An Indonesian court has just acquitted six former high-ranking officials accused of human rights violations in East Timor, a sign of collapsing efforts to punish widespread violence and massacres in 1999. All six were charged with allowing men under their command to commit atrocities, which included rape, murder, and driving hundreds of thousands from their homes. The acquittals outraged human rights groups, which have long demanded that Indonesia prosecute the perpetrators of the wave of killing, burning, and looting that swept East Timor after its people voted for independence. The Bush administration is currently trying to renew military ties with Indonesia. The most powerful Kurdish chieftain in northern Iraq, Massoud Barzani, refused the Bush administration's invitation to attend the meeting of Iraqi opposition figures at the White House last week. The Bush administration had offered to send a private airplane to southeastern Turkey to pick him up and meeting with President Bush. Barzani has 70,000 fighters under his control. His father led the largest Kurdish rebellion of the last century and died in exile in the United States. His refusal was a blow to Bush administration officials. According to the New York Times, they'd orchestrated the meeting to demonstrate to allies that Iraqi opposition forces would unify both on the battlefield and around a post-war government in the event of a U.S.-led attack. More than 300 families of members, 300 family members of victims of the September 11th attacks are preparing to file suit against various interests associated with the government of Saudi Arabia, alleging that they helped finance Osama bin Laden and his network. Lawyer Alan Gerson told the New York Times he expects the lawsuit to be filed today and will seek $300 billion in damages. Attorney General John Ashcroft has announced he wants to create detention camps for U.S. citizens he deems to be enemy combatants. This according to an opinion piece in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times by professor of constitutional law at George Washington University, Jonathan Turley. Turley says Ashcroft's plan was disclosed last week but has not been publicized. Turley writes, the plan reveals Ashcroft has become a threat to our liberties and should trigger immediate congressional hearings and reconsideration of Ashcroft's fitness for office. Meanwhile, the American Bar Association on Tuesday condemned the government's secret detention of hundreds of immigrants after September 11th, demanding to know who has been held and why many detainees have not received legal representation. And a federal judge in Virginia also sharply criticized the Bush administration, saying it has mistreated U.S. citizen Yasser Assam Hamdi by detaining him for months without charges or access to a lawyer. Separately, former Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer has become the first African-American president-elect of the American Bar Association. The American Bar Association banned membership by blacks until 1943. Archer is also a former Michigan Supreme Court justice and a former president of the competing National Bar Association, which was founded in 1925 by African-American lawyers who refused membership in the ABA. Senior U.S. officials asked President Alvaro Uribe Wednesday to shield U.S. military trainers in Colombia from prosecution by the International Criminal Court for any human rights abuses that may arise. AOL Time Warner Chief Executive Richard Parsons acknowledged Wednesday some $50 million in advertising deals at the Troubled America Online unit were improperly stated as revenues. The disclosure coincided with the deadline for chief executives to certify the accuracy of their company's accounting. Some companies revealed they'd overstated their profits. Others said they'd found faulty arithmetic, and others missed the deadline. Illinois-based consumer finance company Household International admitted it overstated its profits by nearly $400 million over 9 years. The company fired its auditor, Arthur Anderson, a few months ago. The Washington, D.C. Election Board on Wednesday fined the campaign to re-elect Mayor Anthony Williams close to $300,000 for submitting thousands of fraudulent signatures on nominating petitions. The FBI has publicly declared Stephen Hatfill is no more or less important than 30, quote, people of interest in the investigation into last fall's anthrax attacks. But law enforcement officials are admitting his photo is the only one being shown to residents of the Princeton, New Jersey neighborhood where a mailbox tested positive for anthrax last week. The Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday shut down a substantial part of the nation's largest processor of donated human tissue, saying CryoLife Corporation could not adequately assure patients that its soft tissue products were free of deadly bacteria or fungi. The FDA said that 27 people had developed serious infections after receiving tissue implants processed by the company, and one of them had died. The state of Texas executed Mexican citizen Javier Suarez Medina last night. This despite a personal call from President Vicente Fox to Texas Governor Rick Perry and appeals from UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson, 12 Latin American nations, and 2 European countries. They say the state of Texas violated the international law by failing to tell Medina he had a right to contact the Mexican consulate. He was 19 at the time of his arrest. Vicente Fox has canceled his trip to the United States in protest of Medina's execution. مين إرهابي أنا إرهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي مين إرهابي أنت إرهابي مكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي قتلني زي ما تلت إجدادي أجل القانون عالفاضي ما أنت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بادي حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أكترية ديمقراطية والله انكم ناسية من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية حبلت ولدت ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية وهنا ديتنا ارهابية يعني ضربتني وبكيت سبعتني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بدين نطيت وحكيت ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرموا حجار ما لهمش اهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنو نسيت انو استحق. Who are the terrorists by damn here on Democracy Now? I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, and good morning to our listeners around the country. And it's a bad week for the airlines this week. First, we had U.S. Air declaring bankruptcy. Then we had American Airlines laying off 7,000 employees. And now we find that United Airlines is threatening to declare bankruptcy. Only in United Airlines' case, the employees supposedly own more than 50% of the shares. So the company has demanded either you give us givebacks or we declare bankruptcy. So either way, the workers lose because they're the main shareholders, as well as the ones being asked to sacrifice once again. And I keep wondering what happened to those billions of dollars in airline bailouts that Congress apportioned right after September 11th.
Meanwhile, speaking of trips, you're headed to Washington. Can you talk about what you're doing in your role as National Association of Hispanic Journalists president?
Well, I'm just still trying to get acclimated to the new role, and we're sort of engaged in some meetings. Actually, some will occur here in New York with some of the news division chiefs of the networks after we pulled their coat of ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN for their continuing policy of having all male white anchors on all of their major news shows and Sunday morning shows. And so some of them have asked to meet with us to discuss the matter. And we'll see what happens. I don't expect much to happen. But
what are you demanding?
Well, we would like to see some change in the coverage of the Latino and other third world communities by the networks, as well as a change in the composition of the major faces providing that coverage, because we think it's interrelated. And we'll see. There hasn't been much progress. In fact, there's ever since the federal courts ruled that the FCC could no longer require certain affirmative action goals of all of the broadcast networks, of all the broadcast stations in the United States, we've seen somewhat of a decline now in the numbers of minorities working in as reporters or producers or news people at many of these TV stations.
You've sent a letter to the heads of all the networks. Have all responded?
Yes, all have responded except for NBC so far.
Well, we except for NBC.
Yeah, we're still waiting. I guess their answer got lost in the mail.
I look forward to hearing how your meetings go and whether NBC will respond at all. Well, this week, the Guardian newspaper of London ran an article called "Selective Memory." That's M-E-M-R-I. And it focuses on a Washington-based nonprofit group known as the Middle East Media Research Institute. The article was by Brian Whitaker. It begins, "For some time now, I've been receiving small gifts from a generous institute in the United States. The gifts are high-quality translations of articles from Arabic newspapers, which the institute sends to me by email every few days, entirely free of charge. The emails also go to politicians and academics, as well as to lots of other journalists. The stories they contain are usually interesting. Whenever I get an email from the Institute, several of my Guardian colleagues receive one too and regularly forward their copies to me, sometimes with a note suggesting I might like to check out the story and write about it." Brian Whitaker goes on to say, "If the note happens to come from a more senior colleague, I'm left feeling that I really ought to write about it. One example last week was a couple of paragraphs translated by the Institute in which a former doctor in the Iraqi army claimed that Saddam Hussein had personally given orders to amputate the ears of military deserters. The organization that makes these translations and sends them out is the Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, based in Washington, but with recently opened offices in London, Berlin, and Jerusalem. Its work is subsidized by U.S. taxpayers because an, quote, independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization has a tax-deductible status under U.S. law. Memory's purpose, according to its website, is to bridge the language gap between the West, where few people speak Arabic, and the Middle East by, quote, providing timely translations of Arabic, Farsi, and Hebrew media." Brian Whitaker finally says, "Despite these high-minded statements, several things make me uneasy whenever I'm asked to look at a story circulated by Memory. First of all, it's a rather mysterious organization. Its website does not give the names of any people to contact, not even an office address. Secondly, the stories selected by Memory for translation follow a familiar pattern. Either way, they reflect badly on the character of Arabs, or they in some way further the political agenda of Israel. I am not alone in this unease." Those are the words of Brian Whitaker, a reporter for The Guardian newspaper in London. But right now, we are going to have a discussion about the Institute, and we're joined by the president of Memory, Yigal Carmon. He was also the former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's top counterterrorism advisor. He will be having this discussion with Ali Abu Nima, vice president of Arab American Action Network, which is based in Chicago. Yigal Carmon, can you tell us about your group, Memory, and what you think of Brian Whitaker's description?
Yes, well, first, allow me to add I was also advisor to Prime Minister Rabin. I don't know why you omitted that. And this was a decade ago. I retired a decade ago. I don't know why Brian Whitaker omitted that, too. His work is really an example of poor journalism, and it's really saddening. I don't know. I would say, whose guardian is he? We are not mysterious. He went in his article back to our old website for through archival material, and there he could see exactly our address. It's not in the new one because we got hate mail and threats from right-wing activists here in America. But our phone is on every piece of ours. We are not such mysterious at all. Now, his main claim is, of course, that, as it says in the title, that
Ali Abu Nima.
And I, pardon?
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And I claim that his reporting is selective. I don't see in his reporting anything of the main debates going on in the Arab world. I don't see in his reports anything that really covers the main foci of issues in the Middle East nowadays. And I would think that he should. For I could give some examples from what he claimed. He argued against our reporting. For example, he says they reported once about a blood libel in a Saudi paper. That about which they apologized. The author, the editor, wasn't there, and they fired the writer.
Yigal Carmona.
That's very nice. However, he fails to say it, this all means to say that this was a marginal thing. But guess what? He doesn't report that the main issue in the Egyptian paper today is a judicial investigation by French authorities against the editor-in-chief of the Al-Ahram newspaper, the main paper in Egypt, who did the same thing. And he decided to go to battle against that charge from the French authorities.
Well,
everybody in Egypt.
Mr. Carmona, if I can just ask you, if you could tell us a little bit about how Memory got started and what its purpose is.
Well, as it says on its website, it got started 4.5 years ago. And the idea was to add to the coverage of the Middle East, which I saw as lacking and unbalanced, an input of primary sources, just to bring in primary sources translated and give people the opportunity to see for themselves what is going what is written in the Arabic media. Primary sources give much more than summaries or other ways of conveying the material. Primary sources have a whole context for which you can see a lot. Also, allow me to continue. He omitted the fact that we do also textbooks. We study textbooks of the Middle East. We did two, one of the Syrian textbooks and one of the new Palestinian one. We have others we are now working on. And we also monitor what is broadcast from mosques in the Middle East in various countries.
Well, I'd like to bring into the conversation Ali Abu Nima, the vice president of the Arab American Action Network and founder of ElectronicIntifada.net. And I'd like your response to Yigal Carmon and Memory.
Well, I think there are basically two things to know about Memory. One is, Mr. Carmon's high-minded claim that they're just providing primary sources. And they are certainly doing that. But the way they do it is extremely selective. If you look at their website, you'll see that every single report which they translate does one of two things. It either reflects very badly on Arabs, or it is critical of Arabs, written by Arabs, criticizing Arabs. And that's fine. I think people should know about these things. But it's extremely selective. For example, while Memory is very concerned to let everyone in the world know about every ugly claim made by an Arab, every anti-Semitic comment, every anti-Israeli comment, they do not provide translations from the Hebrew press in Israel, which is full of similar racist claims against Palestinians and Muslims. Just yesterday, for example, there was a report in Yediot Aharonot, one of the leading Israeli dailies, saying that Israel is reestablishing a government council of, quote, public demographics, and this is designed to increase the Jewish birth rate and reduce the Palestinian birth rate in Israel. I mean, if something like that appeared in the Arabic press, about how to decrease the Jewish birth rate and increase the Arab birth rate, it would be all over the Memory website. But if you look on their website, where it says the languages they translate, they say one of them is Hebrew. But no one has ever seen anything from Memory translated from Hebrew of all of the very severe racist commentary which appears, the calls for ethnic cleansing, the comments from senior Israeli leaders, which exactly mirror some of the very ugly claims coming from the Arab world that Memory documents. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Memory has been can take credit for establishing the myth. I would even go further and say the lie that Palestinian school textbooks are filled with anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli incitement. And there have been a number of independent reports on this, one by Nathan Brown of George Washington University from a few months ago, which is on the web. We have it linked from Electronic Intifada, that says virtually, and I'm quoting from Nathan Brown, virtually every discussion in English on Palestinian education repeats the charge that Palestinian textbooks incite students against Jews in Israel. And he goes on to say, it may therefore come as a surprise to readers that the books authored under the Palestinian National Authority are largely innocent of these charges. And he says, the Palestinian curriculum is not a war curriculum. While highly nationalistic, it does not incite hatred, violence, and anti-Semitism. And his very transparent report is there for everyone to read. But Memory has had great success in propagating this claim. So to sum up, what it's doing with these two strategies is to try to distract attention from the real cause of the conflict, which is the Israeli occupation and the fact that three million plus people are forced to live under the worst form of tyranny, military dictatorship. And obviously the Israeli occupation produces the expressions of hatred on both sides, by Israelis and Palestinians. So this is an attempt simply to try and make us believe that there is an indigenous source for the conflict, which is rooted in Arab hatred and incitement and racism. That's their agenda. And the Brian Whitaker article makes that clear, as well as establishing what we've known for a long time, which is Memories and Mr. Carmon in particular, long-standing connection with Israeli intelligence.
We're going to come back to this discussion in just a minute. Ali Abunima is the founder of ElectronicIntifada.net. Yigal Carmon is a president of Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back with them in a minute. Then a debate on the eviction of white farmers in Zimbabwe with two Zimbabwean members of parliament. Then we'll talk about the reparations march on Saturday. Stay with us. Rocky, Oliver Mitukudzi, here on Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, Ali Abunima, Vice President of the Arab American Action Network based in Chicago, and Yigal Carmon. He is President of the Middle East Media Research Institute, known as Memory, in Washington, D.C., that puts out excerpts of pieces, articles from the Arabic, Farsi, and Hebrew media. Juan?
Yeah, Mr. Carmona, I'd like your, to get your response. Also, one, on the issue of whether you do any translations of extremist viewpoints from Hebrew, and also about Brian Whitaker's claim that at least three of the six staff people formerly listed on your in your organization all have backgrounds, including yourself, with Israeli intelligence.
Well, first let me answer to Mr. Abu Nima's claim. This is a typical example of the way we are treated. He talks about the textbook study of Palestinian textbooks and claims that we have argued that they are full of hatred, etc. He never saw our report. This report that he talks about was done by some other group. We have no connection to it. If we had,
no, I've seen
if
your
he
report.
Had bothered to
I have
go
seen
to
your
our,
report.
Sir, let me speak.
Well, I've
if
seen
he
your
had
report,
gone to our,
so
we
that's
give
simply
them
not
credit.
True what
let
you say.
Me speak now.
Of course
if
I've
we
seen
ha- if he had read, and you can watch it, see it on the web, it's there. We gave them credit. It's simply another book, and Miss and Professor Brown wrote to me an email and apologized for everything that is related to us because we wrote another report. It's two different separate reports.
I've seen I'm talking about your report.
Me. He tries to stick to memory another report.
No,
this
no,
is
that's
typical,
not true. I'm talking
this
about
is
memory's
typical
report.
Of the lie of the way he acts. We
are
have
you denying that you did
report,
a report on Palestinian
not the
textbooks?
One that he talks about.
Are you
it's
denying that
group,
you've done a report on
go,
Palestinian
and
textbooks?
You can go. Don't interrupt me when I speak.
Well,
I
don't
have,
tell
I,
lies.
I have called your bluff, Mr. Abu Nima.
Don't tell lies.
And don't and why don't that, try
you
to...
Yigal Carmon. Yigal Carmon.
Hold it. Hold it. Let's allow Yigal Carmon to finish, please.
You just said you've done one, and now you're denying that you've done one.
Let me just, Yigal Carmon, just so we can understand, Ali Abu Nima, just 1 minute, please. We're going to just fade you both down so that we can hear what you have to say. Yigal Carmon, did memory do a report on?
Hello?
Yes. Did memory do a report on Palestinian textbook?
And we didn't say what he says. We gave them credit for changes. I could read to you from the from our summary of it if you want to. It will show exactly what kind of
Well, yeah. Why don't we move on? You don't have don't.
Let me read it to you. The new Palestinian textbook reflects a general attempt to lessen the virulence of anti-Israel venom. Direct incitement has significantly declined. Explicit calls for violence have been radically reduced, and a serious effort has been made to enhance values such as democracy and freedom. Is that the report you're talking about, Mr. Liar?
Ali Abu Nima.
Well, I'm talking about a lot of claims which come from memory. It's
this
all on
was
the website.
Well, you answered to this it's claim that you have made a few moments ago about the report on Palestinian textbooks. I am reading to you what we wrote.
I was on CNN with you just a few weeks
ago. No, answer
to
my claim. I'm reading to you from page 27
Mr. Carmon, let him finish.
I'm reading to you from page 27 of our report, Mr. Liar.
I don't have your report in front of me, but your website is there for all the world to see.
Okay,
we
don't know what you're saying.
Yigal Carmon, let Ali Abu Nima respond to what you said.
Listen, both of you, this is not the O'Reilly factor, all right? This is not...
He's
this is not the Capital Gang.
It, ma'am. I will. He's not responding to what I'm reading to him. I want his response to what I'm reading to him. He claimed that we blame the Palestinians while I'm reading something else.
Well,
I want.
Okay, let him respond. Let him respond.
From page 27 of our report.
You don't let me. You don't let me. I'm trying to answer it.
Answer to the point.
Well, I'm trying to answer it. You have on your website a lot of reports.
No,
like
we are not.
Hold it. No.
How can I answer if you don't let me?
No. Answer to the textbooks. Don't talk. You raise a point about textbooks. Study.
Well, I'm looking at your. I'm trying to answer about textbooks.
Yes.
You have on your website right now, I'm looking at it, a report number 287 from October 15th, 2001, repeating the claim that Palestinians are teaching their children incitement and hatred of Judaism and Zionism. This is all over your website. The person has to spend no more than 5 or 6 minutes on that to find...
I'll send the station...
We're going to have to... Go ahead.
It's all there. It's all there
absolutely,
for people to see.
And you are a liar.
I mean, okay. You know, the amazing thing here, the amazing
now,
thing
it was my turn to answer to other claims.
No, I haven't
Ali Abu Nima, hold it.
Mr.
Abu Nima, hold on one second.
I
would like to get an answer to the question that I asked. Mr. Carmon, are half of the people that are on your staff former Israeli intelligence people?
The Guardian's code is together, I'm reading from their code, is a newspaper primary mission is the gathering of news. He went to old staff. He took something from 2.5 years ago. At the time we had this. Today, he could see on our new website, we are 30 people. We have people of all nationalities. The staff has changed so much. I haven't changed, right? But all my career was ended a decade ago. The long-standing is a very misleading way to express it. I finished it a decade ago, but the staff has changed, and now we have people of all nationalities in different countries. We have a variety of people.
So you're telling me that Memory has no contact, either overt or covert, with Israeli intelligence?
Of course not. Of course not.
Well,
of course not.
We gave Yigal Carmon the first word, so Ali Abu Nima, we give you the last.
Yes. There is the report we have from Memory is, and I don't know if it's the same one Mr. Carmon is referring to, is called Narrating Palestinian Nationalism, a Study of the New Palestinian Textbooks. And it does indeed make a lot of claims of the kind that I mentioned correctly, and it's copyright 2002 by Memory. And other reports, which are by groups with a similar political agenda to Memory, cite Memory as a source. For example, the one report which Mr. Carmon was referring to, not by his group, which reviewing... mostly relying on material from Memory, states that it becomes patently apparent that Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority has embarked for years on a transparent attempt to fuel hatred of Israel and Jews among the most impressionable members of his populace, end quote. So these are reports from groups which are citing memory as a source for this, citing material provided by Memory, with the explicit intent of spreading this myth, which is designed to make people believe that Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians is not responsible. Then, of course, there is...
Ali Abu Nima, we're going to have to cut you off there, only because our next guests are waiting on the line for a debate on another issue, if our listeners can bear it. Ali Abu Nima, Vice President of Arab American Action Network and founder of ElectronicIntifada.net, and Yigal Carmon, President of the Middle East Memory Research Institute, known as Memory. We will certainly continue to follow this issue. But we're going to move on now to Zimbabwe. Armed supporters of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe last night evicted a family of white farmers who had defied a government order to abandon their land. The deadline for nearly 3,000 white farmers to leave was last week. Earlier this week, President Mugabe said he's determined to redraw the colonial map that has left a tiny white minority with more than half of Zimbabwe's fertile soil. Mugabe extended an olive branch to those white farmers who agreed to abide by the government's decisions. He said cooperative farmers who took part in the land redistribution program would be allowed to keep portions of their farms. We are going to have a debate right now around the issue of land redistribution. Sub-Saharan Africa is in the middle of a drought, which is endangering the lives of tens of thousands of people. The United Nations says the production of corn, the country's staple food, plunged by nearly 70% this year. Nearly half of Zimbabwe's population is in need of emergency food aid. We're joined by David Coulthard, who is Member of Parliament for the Movement for Democratic Change. He is the Shadow or Opposition Justice Minister. Also on the line with us from Zimbabwe is Munyaradzi Gwisai, who is a Member of Parliament and leading member of the International Socialist Organization. Let's begin with David Coulthard. Can you talk about the land redistribution?
Let me say at the outset that land is an unresolved colonial issue in this country. There is an imbalance of land. You're not correct in saying that white farmers own half the fertile land, but they certainly do hold a vastly disproportionate amount of land, and that is a direct result of the colonial legacy. Our party and my colleague Munyaradzi Gwisai and ZANU-PF and everyone in Zimbabwe agreed that there needs to be redistribution of land from this tiny minority to landless peasants in Zimbabwe. The problem that we have, however, is that violence has been used to achieve that. The laws of Zimbabwe have been violated in achieving this. The constitution of Zimbabwe has been violated. And now, critically, as we face this famine where 6 million Zimbabweans are facing starvation within the next few months, viable farms, productive, highly productive farms growing wheat are being shut down, which will exacerbate the crisis even further.
Munyaradzi Gwisai, another member of parliament, you believe the land reform is necessary?
Oh yeah, no, not just it was overdue yesterday. As I've always said, you know, as David says, 6 million people are facing starvation in this country. Both a condition of climatic conditions, but it is also a result, a systematic result, of the marginalization of millions of peasantry into arid, very poor soils. And indeed, over the last few years, certainly since the structural adjustment program started, rural poverty and famine have become perennial things. So you're going to have peasants starving, whether there's a drought or not. And a key condition for resolving this issue is the redistribution of the millions of hectares that have been held by a tiny section of our population, mainly white commercial farmers, descendants of British colonialists. So it has, and indeed one of Mugabe's gravest failures had been the inability to pursue that agenda of redistributing land until very lately, when under the pressure of the rise of the MDC, he was forced to do something for the first time since about 1882.
I'd like to ask David Coulthard. You allege that this has been done by violence and against the laws of Zimbabwe. Could you be more specific? Because I know here in the United States, Zimbabwe, even when it was going through its process of decolonization and its liberation movement, never got so much attention in the U.S. press as it has in the last few months over this issue of land confiscations.
Certainly. The law has been violated in a variety of ways. Firstly, violence has been used. Over 160 people have been murdered in the course of the last 2 years since this program of land acquisition started. Of those 160 murders, some of which occurred in broad daylight, some of which occurred in the presence of police, there have only been two prosecutions. There's been the selective application of law. People who are clearly acting on behalf of Robert Mugabe and his hierarchy have got off scot-free. Now, murders are just the tip of the iceberg. There has been rampant poaching. There's been rape, there's been arson, and something that I need to stress is that the rights of farm workers have been totally ignored in this entire debate. Everyone has focused on white commercial farmers, some 2,000 to 3,000 white commercial farmers, but the international community has entirely forgotten about the plight of some 200,000 to 300,000 black Zimbabwean farm workers who are also being thrown out of their homes. who are also being denied a future. Now, literally tens of thousands of black farm workers have been assaulted, have been subjected to arson, and some of their daughters have been raped, and it has all been done in the name of land reform. Now, we in the MDC, when you run Gwasai and I, are totally at one in this, say, yes, there must be land reform, but why does it have to be done with murder and rape and arson? Now, there's a second way in which it has been done in an unconstitutional manner. We have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution, which cannot be amended very easily. It includes the right to due process of law, as you have in America. It includes the right to reasonable compensation and to reasonable notice being given. Now, both of those rights contained in the Constitution have been violated by laws rammed through Parliament by the ZANU-PF regime. Then direct
excuse me,
Constitution.
But you're saying that that there were laws passed in the Parliament by a majority of the Parliament, so why are you saying that the laws are illegal?
Well, the laws are illegal. Let me explain why. We have a provision, and I believe that you have a similar provision in the United States, that where a law is introduced in a session of Parliament and is struck down, that law cannot be reintroduced in the same session of Parliament. Now, in January, we sat and government introduced a variety of amendments to the Land Acquisition Act. That was struck down by a vote of, I believe, 38 to 22. The MDC voted against it because we believed that it was unconstitutional. Government then tried to ram an identical piece of legislation through Parliament within a couple of days. My colleague Tendai Biti, our shadow foreign minister, went to the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe, and we succeeded in striking down that law in February. Now, that forced ZANU-PF to come back to Parliament in May to pass exactly the same legislation in exactly the same session of Parliament. That is completely unlawful. It violates the Supreme Court ruling of February, and I hope explains to you why this existing law is illegal.
Munyaradzi Gwisai, your response?
I would want to say that this is where we in the left of the party, in the MDC, would... what you have to appreciate with what Mugabe has done is, in many ways, what he has done is illegal, in the sense that he has used Parliament to ram through legislation which justifies what he has done. He's also re-engineered the judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. So I'm not convinced about the issue of legality. No, using it, because the key constitutional amendment that Mugabe made in 2000, I think it was around February, March 2000, was one in fact which justifies the taking of land without paying for the taking of farms without paying for the land, and I think we've got to be. We've argued and continue to argue that we've got to be dead clear on the issue of land, because this is what has allowed Mugabe to sneak through, and which is going to allow him to create a social base. There's got to be a sense of proportions. I mean, 11 white farmers have died. That's nothing compared to the numbers that died during the Liberation War, or those that die in South Africa. To think that you're going to have a major land reform program in which there will not be, you know, to think that will be a legal process, strictly speaking, outside where you've got a very entrenched white minority that has been tampered not only by the Rhodesia Fund, but by Mugabe himself
we
for
have,
the last 20 years, I think is illusion.
We have
so
to...
my own view really is, and what worries us, is as we speak today, Mugabe proclaims that the land reform program is coming to an end of this month. But in reality, the best plantations, you know, in Manicaland, in Mashonaland West, in Mashingo, the best estates, the biggest farms owned by multinationals, they're not being touched.
We have to break.
The irony of Mugabe begging multinationals in Mashingo for land to grow his winter maize one, Why don't you just take it?
We have to break for stations. We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're going to come back to this discussion. Munyarad Zikwisai is a member of the Zimbabwean Parliament, leading member of the International Socialist Organization for Land Reform. David Coulthart, another member of the Zimbabwean Parliament, who is against expelling the white farmers. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Roger Wareham, a leading reparations activist who has gone to Zimbabwe many times. We'll also talk about the reparations march in Washington on Saturday, and Raj Patel of Food First, who has spent a good deal of time as well in Zimbabwe. Stay with us.
If the laws of retribution apply to all of the men, and this restitution granted, and the soldiers freed from the pen, now our backs are to the corner, one desire to for redemption.
Come on and bring on the reparations. For the Birmingham Gospels, four little girls come Sunday. For the Jesus remix in those redneck streets, fire hose, mad dog, crucifix. And what exactly did you say you was doing at the time? As our soft shoe on the rock of edges. For the privilege in your skin, a wounded knee, a trail of tears. For the Indian in us,
we want
all the hip and all the swing. All of the hip and all the cool.
Reparations.
All of the hip and all the swing.
Reparations.
All of the deep and all the cool.
We want
all of the hip and all the
what
swing.
We want.
All of the deep and all the cool.
Reparations.
All the spook with the metal detectors.
Sekou Sundiata. Reparations here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rule is I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about what's going on in Zimbabwe with the eviction of white farmers, the issue of reparations, joined by two members of the Zimbabwean Parliament on the line with us from Harare, David Coulthart, who is against the white farmers being removed and the black farmers moving in, Munyardzi Gwisai, unfortunately having some trouble with the digital technology, understanding member of Parliament, leading member of the International Socialist Organization, and studio with us is Roger Wareham, a leading reparations activist. You're one of the people who's leading the march, the organizing of the march on Saturday in Washington, D.C. for reparations, and you have been working on the issue of Zimbabwe for quite a long time. How do you connect the two?
They're connected very clearly because the whole issue of reparations in the issue in Zimbabwe relates to the right to development. The right to development is a human right that speaks to the right of countries, of peoples, of nations, and of individuals to develop. That right in Zimbabwe has been prevented because the people have not had access to their land so that they could develop as a nation. Similarly, those of us of African descent, not only in the diaspora, but the African continent as well, Zimbabwe is a microcosm, have had that right to development blocked from the time we were kidnapped, brought over here, went through the transatlantic slave trade, went through slavery, went through Jim Crow, went through segregation, and face a de facto segregation today. When you sum up what reparations is about, the repair that's required, it is so that we can develop as fully as possible as human beings. So they're very closely connected. And when you see the interest who opposed the land distribution in Zimbabwe, and you see the people who in the interest that oppose reparations for African people around the world, they are the same people and the same corporations and the same government.
Well, I'd like to ask David Coulthart, the member of Parliament. You say that on the one hand you believe that there needs to be land redistribution in Zimbabwe, but the revolution came to power, independence, and the end of colonialism decades ago, and yet there still has not been any land redistribution. So what is the problem, even in terms of your perspective, in finally getting this land redistribution done?
Okay, let me explain what the problem is. And firstly, if I could just clarify, Lucy, when you refer to me, you say that I oppose whites being thrown off. That isn't correct. I said very clearly at the commencement of this that I support land redistribution. There's no future in Zimbabwe unless this issue is dealt with equitably once and for all. The reason why I fundamentally oppose the manner in which it's being done now is it boils down to two reasons. Firstly, land is not being acquired in many cases for the people Munyarad Zikwisai, my colleague, for the people Munyaradzi thinks should get the land. In other words, landless peasants. What is happening is that in many cases, farms are being acquired by the Mugabe regime and not being handed over to black landless peasants. They're being handed over to the hierarchy of ZANU-PF. The two vice presidents, Vice President Mozenda, Vice President Msika, have been allocated vast land holdings. There are many cabinet ministers who have been allocated farms. Some of these, there's a story of a governor of Mashonaland West Province, Peter Chinetsa, who's been allocated between 6 and 7 farms. Now, that's not equitable distribution. That's not going to provide development for the people who need it. Secondly, the position of the MDC is that we will take, in fact, more land than ZANU-PF has even spoken about. ZANU-PF has spoken about acquiring 5 million hectares. The MDC policy is that we will acquire 7 million hectares, but where we differ from ZANU-PF, and I come back to my colleague who spoke about development, I fully agree with you, sir, that black Africans have been marginalized for hundreds of years, and now is the time to empower them. But ZANU-PF aren't even going to be empowering black Zimbabweans because they're not giving black Zimbabweans title to land. At best, they're getting 99-year leases. At worst, we're going to see a sort of feudal system. Now, the MDC advocates that black Zimbabweans should be given title because we believe that through title, black Zimbabweans will become more empowered. So this is a very complex issue. Let me just make one closing remark.
David Coulthard, I just want to bring Raj Patel into the conversation, who is with the organization Food First, who also has spent a good deal of time in Zimbabwe. Your response, you actually wrote a op-ed, a letter to the editor responding to David Coulthard in the New York Times, who talked about the famine but blames it on land redistribution in Zimbabwe, talks about the drought. Can you respond?
Well, yes. I mean, I think Juan asked a very important question earlier on. Why are we hearing a lot about Zimbabwe at the moment when the U.S. really hasn't heard terribly much about it in the past? And I think that this debate about whether Mugabe is right or wrong distracts from the history of colonialism and actually is not terribly productive in helping to understand not only why the 6 million people in Zimbabwe are starving, but why 13 million people throughout the region are on the brink of famine. I think the question about whether Mugabe is right or wrong is important when it comes to Zimbabwe. But what one seems to be hearing at the moment is sort of the construction of Zimbabwe as sort of the Iraq of southern Africa, a sort of black hole of evil politics, which actually pulls away from a more systematic and thoughtful approach to understanding why people are starving in southern Africa at the moment. And the answer to that is because of structural adjustment policies, as Munyaradzi mentioned earlier on. Structural adjustment policies that have whittled away the food stocks in the region are far more to blame than the parochial politics of any single state in creating a situation where 13 million people now are starving. My response is to say, yes, this debate about Mugabe is important, and the debate that's happening within Zimbabwe is important, but it's pulling away from the fact that what we're seeing is the U.S. engaging in what's tantamount to sort of neo-imperialist policies, because what they're doing now is sending over genetically modified corn to feed the starving in Zimbabwe. And that corn is corn that they cannot sell to the EU or Japan. It's food that the consumers in the EU and Japan will not eat and will not touch with a barge pole. And so the U.S. is, under the guise of aid for the starving, is sending over genetically modified corn, and countries that have the temerity to refuse are being told that beggars can't be choosers. So what I'm saying is that the debate in Zimbabwe is important, but let it not distract us from the urgent concern of the 13 million people in the region who are starving, and who are starving precisely because of U.S. intervention.
Well, Roger Wareham, let's put this in the context as we wrap up the program of what's happening on Saturday and the larger movement for reparations overall, what the demands are at this point.
Well, I think, you know, your listeners weren't privy to the earlier program on WBAI where there was a discussion by people from the Caribbean, different Caribbean countries around this whole issue of reparations, and that there's some lawyers in Jamaica that had brought a lawsuit demanding reparations from the British government. But I think that's very important because what it reflects is that the movement around reparations is globalized, it's international. And that only makes sense because the crime that made it necessary, the crimes against humanity that the transatlantic slave trade and slavery constituted were from their inception international acts. It was Europe invading Africa, bringing enslaved Africans to the so-called new world, which was new to them. The demand for reparations speaks to that. As I mentioned earlier, people are coming to Washington, D.C. this Saturday, and August 17th was not a date chosen by accident. It was the 115th anniversary of the birth of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who in the 20th century led the largest and most successful movement of African people from around the world to deal with the question of how do we as a people, wherever we are, Africa, for Africans at home and abroad, how do we develop? As we're entering the 21st century, this march on Saturday promises to be as historic to this century as the 1963 march in Washington was to that century. We're bringing African people around the world. We're not being divided by culture, language, geography, or all of the sort of artificial divisions that were imposed upon us by coming together to demand reparations. I think that is why the resistance to it has been so great. That is why you don't see any really reporting of it in the so-called corporate media, because reparations threatens the bankrollers of the corporate media. Reparations threatens it raises the question of the very existence of the United States, of Western Europe as it exists today, because they are built, their history and development has been built on blood money and a lie. It has been built on theft. It has been built on torture. It has been built on murder, rape. August 17th, this march in Washington, D.C., is saying that time is over. The victims are taking globalization and using it to organize ourselves, to develop a common strategy and tactics, and to say that it's enough, that the time is over, it's time to pay. You owe us, that debt will be repaid. We ask people to come to Washington, D.C. on August 17th. For further information, there's a website, millionsforreparations.com. That's millionsforreparations.com. There's a number you can call if you're in the local New York area of 718-443-2223, 718-443-2223, and there's a national number, 866-817-5729. That's 866-817-5729.
And among those who'll be speaking on Saturday?
Well, you know what, let me just say very quickly, this is not going to be the usual talking heads. There's going to be people that you've never heard of unless you've been in the local area, because this is a grassroots movement, and it's time that the foot soldiers, the people who have been doing the work but may not have the publicity, have the opportunity to speak, and that's what people are going to hear. So if you're coming expecting to see a galaxy of stars, then don't come. But if you're coming to make a serious demand in a historic rally, then you should be there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Roger Wareham himself involved with a major lawsuit against insurance companies in this country.
Insurance companies.
Like Aetna.
Aetna, New York Life, finance companies,
because
Brown Brothers, Harriman, Citicorp. Because their businesses or their predecessors in interest were born from the transatlantic slave trade and slavery, that they were blood money, that they're the money from which they developed came from the transatlantic slave trade and slavery.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. And next week on Democracy Now!, we will bring the voices of that march to our listeners. And this weekend, Pacifica Radio will be live at the Reparations March in Washington. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Jeremy Scahill, Dexter X. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer today, with Anthony Sloan, a speedy recovery. DemocracyNow.org is our website. It'll give all that contact information if you have missed it. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.